On the Genealogy of Morals by Friedrich Nietzsche. An audio summary narrated for the AIIO Book Library. Nietzsche wrote this in 1887 in about 3 weeks and subtitled it A Polemic. It is the most systematic book he ever produced. A preface and 3 connected essays, each with an argument that runs from beginning to end. If you want to know what Nietzsche actually thought rather than what he chanted, this is the book. He describes it in the preface as a supplement to and clarification of Beyond Good and Evil, which had appeared the year before and had not been understood. That is the right way to place it. The earlier book asserts that our morality has a history. This one tries to show what that history was. The word genealogy is doing precise work. Nietzsche is not asking whether our moral values are true, and he is not asking whether they are useful. He is asking where they came from, who made them, out of what need, and what the making cost. His conviction is that our values feel eternal and self-evident to us only because we have forgotten their birth, and that recovering the birth changes what you think of the thing. He is also explicit about method. He wants documents, etymologies, the actual grey history of morals, rather than the armchair speculation of the English psychologists he mocks in the opening pages. He does not always live up to this. But the ambition, to treat morality as a natural object with a traceable history, is what makes the book still matter. One last thing from the preface. He says the book will be found hard to read and blames the modern inability to ruminate. He wants a reader who will chew, and he says an aphorism has not been understood merely because it has been read. The 3rd essay, he claims, is an example of what he means. A whole essay written as the interpretation of a single sentence. The 1st essay asks where the pair good and evil came from, and it begins by attacking a rival account. The English psychologists, as he calls them, had a story. Originally, unegoistic acts were praised by the people who benefited from them because they were useful. Then the origin was forgotten, and the acts came to be regarded as good in themselves. Nietzsche says this is psychologically absurd. The judgment good did not originate with the people to whom goodness was shown. It originated with the good themselves, meaning the noble, the powerful, and the high-placed, who felt themselves to be good and named their own manner of being so. He then reaches for etymology as evidence. Across languages, he argues, the words for good trace back to words meaning noble, aristocratic, of high birth, and the words for bad trace back to words meaning common, plain, low. In German, he links schlecht, bad, to schlicht, plain or simple. The moral vocabulary, on this account, is a fossilized record of social rank. Then comes the turn the essay is famous for. There was a group who could not affirm themselves in this way, because they had no power to affirm. Their response was what Nietzsche calls resentment, and he keeps the French word because he wants something more specific than resentment. A chronic, brooding hostility that cannot discharge itself in action, and so becomes creative in imagination instead. Slave morality, he says, begins by saying no to what is outside it. Where noble valuation grows out of a triumphant yes to itself and treats its opposite as a pale afterthought, slave valuation needs an enemy first. It defines the powerful as evil and then constructs itself as the opposite of that and calls the result good. This is the crucial structural point of the whole book. The 2 schemes are not the same scale with the terms reversed. They have different starting points and different directions. Noble morality is self-affirmation with an afterthought. Slave morality is a negation from which a self-image is then derived. Nietzsche then does something clever, and it is the most philosophically important passage in the essay. He imagines lambs who resent birds of prey and say that birds of prey are evil, and that whoever is least like a bird of prey, whoever is as much like a lamb as possible, is good. He grants that there is nothing wrong with the lamb's point of view. But then he asks what the birds of prey would say. They bear the lambs no ill will, they simply find them delicious. The argument underneath is about grammar. Popular morality separates strength from its expression as if there were a neutral substrate, a doer standing behind the deed and freely choosing whether to be strong. Nietzsche says there is no such thing. The deed is everything. The doer is a fiction added by language, which needs a subject for every verb. And this fiction, he argues, is not innocent. It is exactly what the weak require. If strength is a choice, then the strong could have chosen otherwise and are blameworthy. And if weakness is a choice, then the weak can present their inability to act as a moral achievement. Not being able to take revenge becomes forgiveness. Cowardice becomes patience. Submission becomes obedience to God. The essay's most bitter pages describe this workshop where ideals are manufactured out of incapacity. He names the historical carriers of the two moralities, and he is provocative about it. He treats the priestly caste as the inventors of the Great Inversion, and identifies Judea as its historical vehicle, and Rome as the noble antagonist. He says the slave revolt in morality began with the Jews and has been victorious for 2,000 years, and he presents Christianity as its triumph rather than its opposite. Two things need saying about that. First, this is a claim about the psychology of a religious and moral tradition, not a racial claim, and Nietzsche's contempt for the anti-Semites of his own day is documented at length in his other books and letters. Second, that distinction did not protect the passage from being quarried after his death, and it is the single most abused thing he wrote. The essay ends with an image and a question. The Renaissance, he says, was a brief reassertion of noble values, and the Reformation put them down again. And the question he leaves open, in a footnote proposing it as a subject for academic study, is whether good and bad might yet be worth reviving against good and evil. The second essay asks where guilt and bad conscience came from, and it opens with a question that sounds strange until you sit with it. How does one breed an animal that is permitted to make promises? The problem is that promising requires memory of the will, not merely remembering something, but continuing to want a thing you decided to want, across time, through changed circumstances, against your own forgetfulness. And forgetfulness, Nietzsche insists, is not a defect. It is an active capacity, a doorkeeper that keeps consciousness clear. Without it, there would be no happiness, no cheerfulness, and no present tense at all. So an animal that can promise has had something done to it. It has had a counter faculty installed against a healthy one. And the historical technique for installing it, in Nietzsche's account, was pain. Only what does not stop hurting stays in memory, he says. That is his summary of the whole prehistory of moral training. He then catalogues the mnemonic devices actual societies used, and the list is deliberately unbearable. Stoning, breaking on the wheel, boiling in oil, flaying, quartering, the ascetic disciplines, the mutilations, the punishments. All of these, in his reading, were techniques for burning a handful of ideas into a creature that would otherwise forget them. The end point of this long process he calls the sovereign individual, a person finally autonomous, who has the right to make promises, who possesses a will that survives circumstance, and whose consciousness of this power he calls conscience in the proud sense. It is worth noting that Nietzsche presents this as a genuine achievement. The essay is not simply an attack on discipline. It is an account of the price of something he considers valuable. Now, the essay's central move, and it turns on a fact about the German language. The German word for guilt is Schuld, and the German word for debts is Schulden. Nietzsche argues that the moral concept of guilt descends directly from the material concept of debt, and that the entire moral world of conscience has its origin in the oldest and most primitive relationship there is, that between creditor and debtor. In this relationship, a debtor who could not pay offered something else as security: his body, his wife, his freedom, his life. And the creditor, in place of payment, was granted a pleasure. The pleasure of doing violence, the enjoyment of exercising power over the powerless. Nietzsche says this without flinching, and he insists that to make suffering into a form of payment requires that watching suffering be genuinely satisfying. Cruelty, he says, was one of the great festival joys of early humanity, and our reluctance to admit this is itself a late development. From here he separates two things that are almost always confused, and this is the essay's sharpest methodological point. The origin of a practice and its present purpose are entirely different questions. A thing arises for one reason, is seized by some other power, reinterpreted and put to a new use, over and over, so that the history of anything is a chain of subjugations and reinterpretations. Punishment, therefore, has no single meaning. It has a long history of meanings layered on top of one another, and the modern belief that punishment exists to awaken remorse is, he says, almost the opposite of what punishment actually achieves. Punishment makes people hard and cold. It sharpens the sense of alienation. It does not produce repentance. So where does bad conscience come from, if not from punishment? Here is the answer the essay was written for. When human beings were enclosed within society and peace, the instincts that had discharged themselves outwardly, in hunting, war, wandering, and destruction, found the exits blocked. And so they turned inward. That, he says, is the origin of bad conscience. The instinct for freedom, forcibly made latent, driven back and turned against the self. He calls this the most fundamental change humanity ever experienced, and describes it as an illness in the way pregnancy is an illness. Man became interesting at the cost of becoming sick. The soul, in the sense of an inner world with depth and breadth, only came into existence because outward discharge was obstructed. The essay ends by explaining how a manageable social debt became an infinite metaphysical one. Every tribe, Nietzsche argues, felt itself indebted to its ancestors, who founded it and whose sacrifices made its existence possible. This debt was paid in offerings and observance, and here he notices a mechanism. The more powerful the tribe becomes, the more it must credit to its founders, and so the debt grows rather than shrinks with success. The ancestor eventually swells into a god. Follow that mechanism to its end point, and you arrive at a maximal god, and therefore a maximal debt. The Christian God, being the most powerful conceivable, generates the greatest conceivable indebtedness. Combine that with the bad conscience already produced by internalized instinct, and the debt is no longer something you owe, but something you are. Guilt becomes irredeemable in principle. Existence itself takes on the character of a punishment. And then the passage he calls the stroke of genius on the part of Christianity. God pays the debt himself. The creditor sacrifices himself for the debtor out of love. Nietzsche treats this as psychologically brilliant and morally appalling in equal measure, because it does not release the debtor. It binds him tighter, since the debt has now cost the creditor everything and can never be discharged by any act of his own. He closes the essay by wondering aloud whether the opposite is possible. Not the marriage of bad conscience to the guilt of God, but bad conscience turned against the unnatural inclinations themselves. That would require, he says, a person of great health and great strength. And he then declines to say more, remarking that such a task belongs to someone younger and stronger than he is. The third essay is the longest and the strangest, and it is the one Nietzsche said was written as the interpretation of a single aphorism. The question is this: why has the ascetic ideal, the ideal of self-denial, of poverty, humility, and chastity, of turning against one's own instincts, been so overwhelmingly powerful across human history? Why does it keep winning? He works through the constituencies one at a time. For artists, the ascetic ideal means nothing much. Artists borrow whatever philosophy is going and lean on it. Nietzsche uses Wagner as his example, and the treatment is not kind, given that Wagner had ended his life in a posture of Christian renunciation. An artist standing on an ideal is a case of a servant needing a master. For philosophers, the ascetic ideal has been a set of favorable conditions rather than a conviction. Poverty, chastity, and humility are, he suggests, simply what a thinker's work requires, and philosophers adopted the priestly costume because in the early days it was the only available disguise for the contemplative life. Here he inserts the most quoted passage in the essay on perspectivism. There is no disinterested contemplation, no knowing without a point of view. The demand for an eye turned in no direction is nonsense. What we can do, he says, is use more eyes, different eyes, and the more affects we allow to speak about a thing, the more complete our concept of it will be. For women and for the physiologically failed, the ideal serves other purposes, and he handles these briskly. But the essay's real subject is the ascetic priest, and the priest is where Nietzsche's analysis becomes something more than polemic. The ascetic priest, Nietzsche says, is a paradox, life turning against life, and a self-contradiction of that scale must serve some function, or it would have died out. His answer is that the priest is a physician, not a good one, but a real one. The herd is sick, suffering, and in danger of turning its suffering into a suicidal resentment against existence, and the priest is the one who steps in and manages it. He is the direction changer of resentment. The mechanism is the essay's most acute observation. What human beings cannot bear, Nietzsche argues, is not suffering. It is meaningless suffering. Pain that has a reason attached to it can be endured almost indefinitely. Pain that means nothing produces a rage that will destroy a person and everyone near them. So the sufferer asks, "Why do I suffer?" And he goes looking for a cause because he needs one. And the priest supplies it. "You suffer because of you. You are guilty. The suffering has a reason, and the reason is your own sin." Nietzsche calls this an interpretation and a false one, and then says the crucial thing: it worked. It gave suffering a meaning. It closed the door on the resentment that would have turned outward and shattered the community by turning it inward instead. The sick were made harmless to the healthy at the price of being made permanently ill. The priest saved the herd by poisoning the wound. He then goes through the priest's other techniques with something like professional admiration, the deadening of the feeling of life altogether, mechanical activity and small joys as distraction, the organization of the weak into a community where their weakness becomes their bond, and finally the orgy of feeling, the deliberate provocation of intense emotion as a discharge. The final movement of the essay is the part most people do not see coming, and it is the reason the book still gets argued about. Nietzsche asks where the opponents of the ascetic ideal are. Where is the counter-movement? And he says that modern science, which believes itself to be the great adversary of religion, is nothing of the kind. Science is the ascetic ideal's most recent and most refined expression. His reasoning is this: science is not free of faith. It rests on a valuation that it cannot itself justify. That truth is worth having, that truth matters more than comfort, more than illusion, more than life itself, if it comes to that. Where does that conviction come from? It is, he says, the same unconditional will to truth that Christianity trained into Europe over 2 millennia. The scientist who sacrifices his illusions to the truth is performing exactly the ascetic gesture in a new costume and with the same underlying belief in a divine order of things that is worth submitting to. And then he turns the screw. This will to truth, having demolished the Christian dogma, must eventually turn on itself and ask what the value of truth is. That, he says, is the great spectacle in store for the next 2 centuries, and Christianity will perish of its own morality, as truthfulness, examined truthfully, discovers its own origins. The book's last sentence is the summation of everything before it. Man would rather will nothingness than not will at all. Read that carefully, because it explains why the ascetic ideal keeps winning. It was never mainly about God. It was about having something to want. Given a choice between a meaning that turns you against yourself and no meaning whatsoever, human beings will take the first every time, and the ascetic ideal has been, for 2,000 years, the only offer on the table. The argument in summary, that values have a history, that the history is not what we assume, and that recovering it changes what we think of the value. That the origin of good and bad was social rank, and that the words themselves preserve the record. That good and evil is a different and later scheme, invented out of resentment, which begins with a no to an enemy and derives its self-image from that refusal. That the doer behind the deed is a fiction supplied by grammar, and that this fiction is what allows weakness to be presented as moral achievement. That the moral concept of guilt descends from the material fact of debt, and that the whole apparatus of conscience grew out of the creditor and debtor relationship. That memory in human beings was manufactured by pain, because only what does not stop hurting stays in the mind. That the origin of a practice and its current purpose are separate questions, and that everything with a history has been repeatedly seized and reinterpreted. That bad conscience arose when the instincts could no longer discharge outward and turned inward instead, creating the inner life as a wound. That the ascetic priest is a physician who cures the herd's resentment by redirecting it against the sufferer himself, giving suffering a meaning at the cost of making it permanent. That what people cannot bear is not suffering, but meaningless suffering. That there is no view from nowhere, and that objectivity is better understood as the ability to employ many perspectives rather than none. That science is not the opponent of the ascetic ideal, but its latest form, because it inherits the unconditional will to truth without examining it. And that human beings would rather will nothingness than not will. Here is the reasonable criticism, and there is a good deal of it. The history is largely invented, This is the most serious charge, and it is well-founded. Nietzsche presents himself as doing documentary work, and then supplies almost no documents. His etymologies are unreliable, and some are simply wrong. His picture of a noble prehistory followed by a priestly inversion is not supported by the anthropology or the classical scholarship, then or now. The book is best read as a philosophical hypothesis dressed in historical clothing, and Nietzsche's own rhetoric encourages a confusion about which it is. The genetic point is limited. Showing where a value came from does not show that it is wrong. Nietzsche generally knows this and is asking about worth rather than truth, but the essays repeatedly rely on the emotional force of a disreputable origin, which is a fallacy when it is used as an argument and only a suggestion when it is not. The first essay was catastrophic in its afterlife. Whatever Nietzsche meant by naming Judea as the vehicle of the slave revolt, and however clearly his other writing repudiates anti-Semitism, this text was assembled into something monstrous after his death by a sister who was an anti-Semite and who controlled his estate. The distortion required suppression and selective quotation. It also required these pages. The alternative is missing. Having taken the moral world apart, Nietzsche does not put anything in its place. He gestures toward a redeeming figure, then explicitly declines to describe him. Readers have been filling that space with their own preferences ever since, which is precisely the danger of leaving it empty. And the reflexive problem is real. If the will to truth is the last form of the ascetic ideal, what exactly is Nietzsche doing in this book? He raises the question himself in the final sections and does not answer it. What survives all of that is still enormous. The idea that morality has a history rather than a foundation, the separation of origin from purpose, the account of resentment, the recognition that suffering needs meaning more than it needs relief, and the refusal of the view from nowhere have all become permanent equipment for anyone thinking about ethics, psychology, or history, on reading order, because it matters with Nietzsche more than with most. This is the book to start with. It is the only one he wrote as sustained argument. The three essays are self-contained, and everything else he thought is visible from here. Beyond Good and Evil, from the year before, is The Companion. Nietzsche described this book as a supplement and clarification of that one, and the pair are best read together in either order. Thus Spoke Zarathustra is the famous one, and the worst entry point. It states these ideas as prophecy, which makes them memorable and unfalsifiable at the same time. Read it once you know what he is arguing. The Birth of Tragedy is the early Nietzsche, 15 years before this, still under the influence of Schopenhauer and Wagner. It is a different writer, and he says so himself in the self-criticism he added to the second edition. The Genealogy is the book where Nietzsche stops announcing and starts arguing, and it is the one that changed what came after him. Freud, Foucault, and most of what we now call critical theory are downstream of the move made in these three essays. To stop asking whether a value is true and start asking whose interest it serves, what need produced it, and what it cost. That move can be abused and has been. It can also be turned on Nietzsche and should be. But the question at the center of the third essay has not gone away, and it is worth carrying out of this summary. Human beings can endure almost any amount of suffering, provided it means something. If the meanings on offer are ones that turn us against ourselves, and the alternative is no meaning at all, which are we actually going to choose? That was the summary of On the Genealogy of Morals by Friedrich Nietzsche. This narration is an original summary and commentary, and it paraphrases rather than reproduces any translation. If it caught you, read the real thing. From the AIIIO Book Library, thank you for listening.